This is the third time that I've been asked to be a speaker at an ex-Mormon conference. Either the committee really likes to hear me talk, or they're hoping that the third time's the charm, this time I'll get it right. I noticed by show of hands that a lot of you have never been to an ex-Mormon conference before, so you couldn't have heard me talk, so I can use some of the same material. Thank you very much. The first time I talked at an ex-Mormon conference, about 4.5 years ago, I talked a little bit about sex, and that was apparently interesting enough that they didn't notice anybody nodding off. On the second occasion, I gave a brilliant talk about the rules of evidence based on my legal training, logical fallacies, and the syllogism, and that had people snoring. Even though I did put one of the syllogism rules to music, and I sang it, but it didn't do any good. So I won't talk about that. When I asked the committee what I should talk about, they suggested that you might like to hear about some of my experiences since I left the church and since I got involved in the Recovery from Mormonism groups. So the title of my talk is Reflections of an Old Apostate in a Brave New World. I had written a great talk, but I timed it and it ran for 2 hours. So I had to cut out all the sex and most of the funny stories. You can think of that as the sealed portion, which will be revealed in the Lord's own good time. Another thing about an after-dinner speaker at a convention like this is you sit through all the other talks, and I'm sitting there crossing things off that people have already mentioned during my talk. So this talk is going to be shorter than I had originally intended. Of course, I'm the old apostate. The word old is one of those English words that has two meanings. It can be the opposite of young, or it can be the opposite of new. And I'm an old apostate in both meanings of the word. I'm certainly not young anymore. Getting old is something that happens to everybody, unless you die. But old age sneaks up on you. You're not aware of it. You don't realize it's happening to you. Suddenly it hits you. This is how it happened to me. I was buying something in the store, and the price was $10, or $6, and I gave the girl a 10, and she handed me back $4.60. I said, "You're giving me too much change." She said, "That's your senior discount." I also knew I was in trouble in 1992 when Bill Clinton was elected president. It wasn't anything political. I just realized that for the first time in my life, I was older than the current president of the United States. And I also realized that I was older than my doctor, my lawyer, my dentist, my insurance agent. They're all kids. My barber is still older than I am, but I don't think he'll last much longer. Last June, there was a long article in the Wall Street Journal on aging with the latest research on why we age, how to slow it down, and how to extend our life expectancy. Obviously, I'm at a point where I read that kind of article because it interests me. Scientists now believe, it said, that the maximum possible human life expectancy is about 120 years. The only reason that so few of us actually reach that age is because we die first. Now, I think I could have figured that out, and I'm not a scientist. The article gave suggestions on how to reduce the effects of aging, and it was the usual advice. You know, eat healthy foods, exercise more, do not abuse alcohol. Well, I'm good on that last one. I wouldn't think of abusing alcohol. My wine is all stored on its side. I never shake the bottle. It's kept in a cool place. It also said to avoid stress. So I avoid reading the national headlines. I have learned that if there's a problem in the world, I just trust the government. For example, take this bird flu thing. You know, I'm just waiting for the president to get the word from his chief advisor. I'm not talking about Rove. I'm talking about God. And as soon as he gets that word, he'll declare war on bird flu. And that'll take care of it. You've been reading about the problem over in Germany, haven't you, where neither party got a majority, so both parties are having to work together on a coalition. they're not too unhappy about it, because that way when the country really goes to the dogs, each party can blame the other one. And I understand they're calling it the American plan. I'm an old apostate in the other sense, too. I am not a new or recent apostate. I probably left the church before many of you were even born. It was about 1957, 48 years ago. After 3 years of intensive research, trying to prove that the church was true, it finally dawned on me that it was just a man-made religion. Until that moment, it had never occurred to me that there was any possibility that it wasn't true. I simply knew that it was true. I had never asked God about it, because you don't ask God to tell you something that you already know. That revelation that the church wasn't true, I call it a revelation, that cost me my marriage and my family. My Mormon wife left me and took the 3 young kids. The church I left in the 1950s was quite different from the church today. And I'm not talking about all the dozens of additional revelations which have been received by the prophets since then. Well, I guess there's only been one about letting the blacks have the priesthood. But it was different. When I left, David O. McKay was the president. Church membership had not yet reached 2 million. It was not a wealthy church. There were only 10 temples, and you needed a separate recommend for each one. And the temples then were so different. In those days, you had to wear a special temple garment for the endowment, with a little collar, sleeves to the wrist, and legs to the ankles, with the closure in front, and no buttons or snaps. It was held together with 4 little ribbons, which had a special symbolic significance that I've forgotten. And the everyday garment was also different. No two-piece garments then, no. And the markings were actually cut through the fabric like buttonholes, not just sewed on. When you did an endowment for the dead, you did the whole thing, including the washing and anointing. And they really washed you. You took off the shield and hung it on a hook, and there you stood, naked, being washed and anointed. And you had to bring your own towel. And our temple suitcases were larger then, because we had to carry so much more. And, of course, there were no movie projectors in the temples then. I vividly remember going to the Oakland Temple Open House in 1964, and when I saw those movie screens, I almost started to laugh. Here, the most solemn and sacred ceremonies of the church were going to include watching a movie. I was certain then that the church was in apostasy. The endowment ceremony itself, of course, has also changed fundamentally, especially since 1990. In the 50s, it included a part where a Protestant minister was depicted as an employee of Lucifer. He usually led us in singing some Protestant hymn, like "Bringing in the Sheaves" or "Shall We Gather by the River." They took that out. They also took out the 5 points of fellowship at the veil, and they changed the sign of the second token of the Melchizedek priesthood from saying "Pele Ale" to "Oh God, hear the words of my mouth." And, of course, they removed the penalties where you made the motion of slitting your throat and ripping your chest open and disemboweling yourself. I have heard young Mormons deny that there ever were death penalties in the endowment. Church, when I left, had no family home evening, no 3-hour block of meetings, no correlation committee, no strengthening the members committee, no blacks. Actually, there were no blacks then. They were called Negroes. And of course, Joseph Fielding Smith called them darkies. Nobody was pressured to go on a mission. I would guess that of worthy young men my age in my Mormon community, only about 10% actually went on missions. There was no pressure to go frequently to the temple, since there probably wasn't a temple nearby. And not so many members had temple recommends. It had not yet become that general badge certificate of worthiness that it is today, where you have to have a temple recommend to do things like baptize your own child. When I left the church, the Book of Abraham papyri were still lost. Mark Hoffman had not yet sold his forgeries to the prophets of God. The other versions of the first vision had not been discovered. There were no farms yet, because there was no Utah lighthouse. In fact, I was chatting with Sandra Tanner a few years ago, And she mentioned that she had attended the dedication of the Los Angeles Temple, which means that I have been out of the church longer than the Tanners. I'm really an old apostate. And there was no internet. I had to research my way out of the church without the internet, without the wonderful reprints from the Tanners. I was fortunate, however, because I had excellent access to good libraries at the universities where I was studying, especially the Deering Library at Northwestern in Illinois, which has an excellent collection on Mormon history. Once I had left the church, I had no great anger or bitterness towards the church or its leaders. Sure, they had messed up my marriage, but I eventually recovered. I remarried a wonderful woman who knew nothing about Mormons. She thought that Mormons and Mennonites were about the same thing. And I got on with my life. I saw the church and its claims as an intellectual problem, and I assumed that others did too. I didn't even know any other ex-Mormons. Over the years, I followed a few developments in Mormonism when they showed up in the news. Then in 1996, our small town finally got connected to the internet. And what does any Mormon or ex-Mormon do soon after they realize what the internet can do? Why, you do a search for Mormon, or maybe ex-Mormon. And I soon found Eric Kettenen's website at www.exmormon.org. You remember the feeling you got when you found Eric's website and started reading the stories of people who were just like you? Thank you, Eric. So I subscribed to the email list that Eric and some others had set up, and I felt right at home, and I've been subscribed there ever since. I had put together for my own interest, a listing of Joseph Smith's failed prophecies based partly on a list compiled and printed privately by ex-Mormon Dick Baer. And I posted that on the email group. Eric picked it up, put it on his website, and my career as an ex-Mormon writer, actually anti-Mormon writer, had begun. Like most of us who have Mormon families, it was important to me that they understand why I left the church. Some of us write long papers to hand out to family. Although most Mormon family members won't read it, it's still a good thing to do. It's cathartic, and it helps us clarify our own ideas. A few years ago, my younger brother told me how great a blow it had been for him when I left the church when he was a teenager. I thought he was inviting me to tell him why I had left. No, he quickly interrupted me and said, "Richard, I don't give a damn why you left the church." And I knew he meant it because he said, "Damn." I was so frustrated that he refused to hear what I had to say that I gave outlet to my frustration by writing a parable, The Man Who Bought a House. It's about a man who buys a beautiful old house. When his brother asks him if he had the house inspected, the man says that the real estate agent had inspected the house and said it was just fine. And the brother noses around a bit and discovers that the foundation is full of dry rot that has just been covered over with several layers of paint. The man only gets mad when the brother tells him. When I put that parable on my new website, I was astonished at the wide audience it reached. I was beginning to realize the power of the internet. I got dozens of emails, some of them asking me what it meant, others wanting permission to copy it. It is now at about 25 different places on the internet, including Christian websites, atheist websites, a paint manufacturer's website, and a dog breeder's website. Where the webmaster is encouraging dog breeders to examine the genetic foundation of their breeding stock. Yes, I did start a website. That's another thing that a lot of ex-Mormons do. We either write a book or put up a website. I haven't written a book because there are already so many excellent books out there by ex-Mormons, and also probably I'd never finish a book. And of course, the same consideration did not stop me from doing a website. There were and are many excellent websites critical of Mormonism, and I take my hat off to most of them. My website is pretty minimal compared to the Tanner's Utah Lighthouse website or to R.P. Seaman's huge collection at lds-mormon.com or to ericsexmormon.org and too many others to name. The next thing I wrote was what I called my investigator's tract, a short working summary of Mormonism that could be handed to investigators to give them tools for checking out the missionary's story. Its title is To Those Who Are Investigating Mormonism, What the Missionaries Don't Tell You. It summarizes in a very factual, straightforward, and non-argumentative way what the missionaries tell investigators about Mormonism, and then follows a point-by-point listing of each of those claims and what the missionaries don't tell you about it, with numerous links to other websites with facts. It also summarizes for the investigator what life as a Mormon will be like for the convert. Again, non-argumentative, just facts like you're going to give up coffee, you'll be paying tithing, three-hour meetings, etc., special underwear, many callings, and so on. Eric also posted this on his website at exmormon.org, and so it also got a lot of attention. It has been copied on dozens and dozens of other websites, and has been including Christian websites, atheist websites. It's been translated into six foreign languages that I know of: German, Italian, Portuguese, Finnish, Russian, and Danish, and I did not solicit the translations. People came to me and asked me if they could translate it and post it on their website. By the way, if any of you are native Spanish speakers, there's not yet a Spanish translation. And the effect of that investigator's tract has been really heartening. My brother, the bishop, said that his son, my nephew, had encountered it in the hands of an investigator family while he was on his mission in New Zealand. And they asked him, "Elder Packham, do you know who this Packham is who wrote this?" And he had to confess, "That's my uncle." A non-Mormon mother recently wrote me to say that her husband had used it as an outline to talk their recently converted son out of the church. I've had hundreds of emails with similar stories, crediting that little tract with keeping someone out or getting someone out of Mormonism. I added some more original articles to my website and volunteered to have my name put on the helpers list at exmormon.org. And I'm there with Kathleen and a few other people. And so I have received a lot of email over the years. I usually have to spend most of my morning reading and responding to my email. In the beginning, I did not really have a negative picture of the church. It was simply not true. I took it for granted that the church does a lot of good, and if you don't really care whether it's true or not, then it's as good a place to be as any. But as I read the hundreds of emails I kept getting, as well as the posts on the email lists and the many stories added at exmormon.org, I changed my mind. Some days, I would find myself in front of my computer screen, hardly able to see the screen for the tears, reading about the devastation, misery, heartache, and broken lives that were the product of this organization and its members and its leaders. And I finally had to admit that however much good the church may do, however many people it may have helped, it is, on balance, evil. That's my response to what I have come to call the argument that I often get. They do a lot of good. Well, I call it the Hitler built the Autobahn argument. When I lived in Germany in the 1960s, I occasionally would hear old Germans say, "Well, Hitler made a lot of mistakes, but he pulled us out of the Depression. He made jobs for the unemployed. He got rid of the petty crooks. He opposed communism. He built the Autobahn." I'm certainly not saying that Gordon Hinckley or Joseph Smith is comparable to Hitler, or that Mormonism is as evil as National Socialism. But one cannot praise the good and overlook or forgive the evil. Mormons will say, of course, that, well, naturally those people say bad things about the church. to excuse their real reason for leaving. One cannot expect to hear anything good about the church from its critics. Well, I think of them not as critics of the church, but rather its victims. Until the internet, they were generally isolated, alone, and usually silent. Probably the average tithe-paying Mormon is unaware of their existence and of what the church did to damage so many lives. And they probably would prefer not to know. But then, the average patriotic German was unaware of the gas chambers, too. First time I read a story on exmormon.org from a victim of church-related child abuse, I was outraged and almost unbelieving. That could not have happened. At least, it must have been a very unusual case. But I soon learned that it was not. The incidence of child sexual abuse by priesthood holders is one of the nastiest secrets of the church. And tell me that they have indeed figured out that the church is not true, but who are stuck at home or dependent on parents for support through college, which often means support only while at BYU. Also sad are the young people who are not Mormon, but who are madly in love with a Mormon, and they want to know whether there will be a problem. I get so many of those that I put together a frequently asked questions file on my website with comments from people who did that is, married a Mormon or converted to in order to marry a Mormon, and later regretted it. Yes, there will be problems. Often they insist that the Mormon beloved says, oh, the difference in religion is not important. Maybe not now, but in a few years, when the children come, when the pressure from the Mormon in-laws increases, there will be stormy seas. Another kind of email I frequently get is from non-Mormon parents who are devastated at the announcement by their son or daughter that they are going to be baptized into the Mormon church. These are people, of course, that were mentioned in Dwayne's statistics about how it's people who join cults are often the 16 to 20-year-old kids. Well, they're joining Mormonism. Sometimes the kids have already been baptized without telling the parents. Often the parents are taken completely by surprise since they have raised their child as a devout Baptist or Catholic or evangelical. There were so many such parents that I finally started an email list for them for mutual support at Yahoo called Mormons Have My Child, which now has over 150 subscribers. These are angry people. No ex-Mormon can outdo these parents in their hatred, anger, and disgust at the Mormon Church and what it has done to their children. Their anguish and sorrow is heart-wrenching. I wish that the general authorities could read some of their posts, especially when a child marries in the temple and these loving parents are made to stand outside and wait or sit in the foyer and have somebody explain to them why they're not being allowed inside. Mormons can be so cruel at these times. One non-Mormon mother wrote that her daughter's Mormon mother-in-law came out of the temple after the ceremony and told her how sad it was that she couldn't have been there at such an important event in her daughter's life. And she replied, probably through clenched teeth, "I was there at the most important event when she was born." Right. One Mormon mother-in-law tried to explain to the non-Mormon mother of the bride about why non-Mormon parents are excluded. And when the explanation wasn't working as intended, she said, "Well, that's just the way it is." When the non-Mormon parents then arranged a reception for that couple, complete with an open bar, the Mormon mother-in-law objected, saying, "Well, the Mormons would be offended by liquor at the reception." And the mother replied, "Well, that's just the way it is." One Mormon bishop, I have to hand it to him. There are some very wise bishops in the church. He had a great solution to that problem. When the non-Mormon parents told him of how hurt and sorrowful they were, that they would be excluded from witnessing the ceremony, the bishop decreed that nobody, including the worthy Mormon friends and family, could be there. and that the temple workers would act as witnesses. Of course, the Mormons felt that was unfair, and they were very hurt. I know one man who keeps a photograph of his daughter in her wedding dress on his desk at work and uses every opportunity to show it to visitors and comment how he was not allowed to see her get married because the Mormons considered him unworthy. He considers it great negative publicity for the church. We've had some successes in that Mormons Have My Child group. One son of non-Mormon parents had just recently married in the temple the month previous, and his dad invited him to go on a weekend fishing trip. And the dad had done his internet research. As they drove to the lake, father said that he was thinking about buying a new pickup truck. I won't name the actual make of truck. I'll call it by a fictional name, a Lightning. He knew that his son's favorite make of car was Toyota. Well, the son was surprised and shocked. He said that, well, the consumer's reports on the Lightning were bad. There were lots of problems with it. The dad replied, well, that he hadn't bothered to check consumer reports because the Lightning dealer had told him it was a good truck, and he felt good about the idea of a Lightning. But, Dad, you should always check consumer reports before you buy a truck. How about before you join a church? Said the dad. Well, the son got the point. So they fished and they talked all weekend about what the father had learned on the internet about Mormonism. And when the son got back home, he told his new wife that he was leaving the church. She broke down in sobs, called her mother. Her mother came right over and moved her out. So much for families are forever. Occasionally, I even get emails from Mormon missionaries who are troubled by their experience in the mission field and have come to believe no longer. One was near the end of his mission, so he postponed telling anyone of his apostasy until he got home. Another had just been a few months in the field, and he didn't know what he was going to do. He discussed it with his companion, who decided that he didn't believe it either. So the two of them were spending their time seeing the sights, listening to rock music, soaking up the forbidden culture. I haven't heard from them lately. I suspect they were found out and sent home. I get a lot of email from angry Mormons telling me that all my information is false. I ask them politely to provide me with the correct facts. Well, they rarely reply. Well, sometimes they try to explain things like, well, the Bible commands us to pay tithing, or that tobacco and coffee really are bad for you, or why the church banned blacks from the priesthood. One guy told me he knew why the church had not allowed blacks into the priesthood, but he didn't want to burden me. If I would really like to know the reason, let him know, and he'd tell me. So I wrote back and said, yeah, I'd like to know. His answer was, because God commanded it. So, I point out to these people that I'm not arguing about tithing or coffee. I'm merely telling investigators what they are not told by the missionaries until after they have committed to baptism. A lot of Mormons will write, and they want to know why I take the time to be so critical of the Mormon church. They insist that Mormons don't go around criticizing other religions. Oh, really? I point out to them that I'm doing nothing basically different from what Mormon missionaries are doing, all 50,000 or so of them. They go from door to door, like salesmen, trying to engage people in conversation about religion. Their message is fundamentally this: your present religion is false. And that's my message to Mormons and to those who are investigating Mormonism. Mormonism is false. I've also been cursed by the authority of the Melchizedek priesthood. I've told this story before, but a lot of you have not heard it, so I'll go ahead and tell it again, all right? Because I think it's a good story. A very devout and faithful Mormon who had found my website angrily wrote to me and used his authority as a holder of the Melchizedek priesthood to pronounce a curse on me. The same curse with which Alma cursed Korihor in the 30th chapter of the book of Alma. Namely, that I be struck dumb and have no more utterance. And this was to be a sure sign of the power of his God and his priesthood. I immediately emailed him back and used my authority to prophesy that his curse wouldn't work. And also that he would be soon giving me excuses as to why it didn't work. I was not struck dumb. I didn't even get a sore throat. When I wrote him this, his first excuse was, well, it would take effect sometime later. I responded that Alma's curse took effect immediately. His next excuse was that he had not used the words, in the name of Jesus Christ. I suggested that he try it again and use the right words. Alma hadn't used those words either, actually. His next excuse was that he had cursed me in anger, implying, I suppose, that one can curse effectively only if done with love and kindness. His final excuse was that apparently only one priesthood holder at a time has the keys to do such smiting, and he wasn't the one. Although Alma had been the one, right? Implying, I guess, that I would have to be taken to Salt Lake City before Gordon Hinckley, as Korihor was taken before Alma. But, you know, the false priests of Baal could not call down fire from heaven, and so the false priests of Mormonism can't strike anybody dumb. Talk about a sign of the power of the priesthood. And my prophecies were fulfilled. One Mormon suggested a public debate with me. He lived in Wyoming. And I accepted his challenge and offered to come to Wyoming from Oregon at my own expense. I suggested we get a non-Mormon lawyer to act as moderator, and that the topic be whether Joseph Smith was a liar. I thought we had it all set up, but he had to cancel because of bad health. I also offered to debate a Mormon bishop in Saskatchewan who wrote me some very nasty emails. They're all posted on my website because he insisted that I post our correspondence, though I did. He refused to debate me on the grounds that I would probably say some things that he would find offensive. It was just like my brother, the bishop, who said that he would really like to know why I don't believe the gospel, but only if I could tell him my reasons without saying anything critical of the church or the church leaders. It's funny how the Mormons want respect and consideration for what they believe, but they don't want the painful truth, nor do they want to give respect to what you believe or even know about it. As Dave Berry has said, you know, people who want to share their religious views with you almost never want you to share yours with them. I also get some emails from non-Mormons who have found that the Mormons have baptized their ancestors into the Mormon church. Some are quite indignant and want to know what they can do about it. One man wrote to me, I recently saw in a Mormon genealogy that my great-great-great-grandfather, John Ebenezer Riley, was endowed or consecrated or some other term into the Mormon church. What does this mean? John Riley was a lifelong primitive Baptist and even an elder of that sect. Is he turning over in his grave at what has been done to his memory? So I wrote back to him, and I said, well, if it's any consolation to you and to other descendants of John Riley, the Mormons are devoting tremendous amounts of time, energy, and money to doing the same thing to every person who ever lived on this planet. So he is not alone, nor are you. I then explained a little bit about Mormon beliefs about the work for the dead. I went on and I said, if this bothers you, I suggest you notify the Mormon church authorities at 50 East Northeast North Temple Street, Salt Lake City, that you have posthumously baptized Brigham Young into the Primitive Baptists. Some emails are from Mormons who acknowledge that, well, maybe the doctrines of the church are not all true, but Mormonism is a good way of life, and it's a good way to raise children. Well, I certainly acknowledge that there are many Mormons who are happy in the church and would be completely lost without it, just as a diabetic would be lost without the insulin. I tell those folks that my website is not intended for them, but rather for those Mormons who have the vague feeling that something is not right about Mormonism, who have doubts about its claims, or who are convinced by the church that if they have doubts, there is something wrong spiritually with them. So the facts on my website enable such people to have confidence in their own insights and impressions, to let them know that they are not weird or wrong for doubting. And it's also for non-Mormons who are just beginning to investigate Mormonism, who are not getting all sides of the Mormon story, but only the sanitized milk before meat version as presented by the missionaries, and would not think of joining the Mormon Church if they knew the whole story. I asked one missionary, I said, did you tell people about this and that? And I named a few things, and he said, well, no, of course not. I said, why not? He said, well, because they wouldn't have joined. Every religion in the world can boast of adherents who claim that their lives have been improved by their religion. So the fact that a medication works does not prove that it is not a placebo. As for Mormonism being a good place to raise children, I vehemently deny that. Yes, Mormon children are perhaps less likely to do drugs or alcohol or have promiscuous sex and be disobedient to authority. But there is a terrible price to pay in guilt, insecurity, other psychological damage. And for more of my views on this subject, if you're interested, see my article, Raising Children as Mormonism. One of the big lies about why people leave the church is about why people leave the church. Mormons generally insist, because the leaders have told them so, that the only reason people leave are because they have sinned, or they want to sin, or they're too weak to keep the commandments, or because some member or leader has offended. One new convert stopped going to church because he got the impression that the Mormons think they're better than everybody else. The Mormons would say that he was too sensitive or too critical. I think he realized these arrogant people could not possibly be true followers of Christ. Another new convert told me that after she went to church a few times wearing her usual tailored slacks, the Relief Society president went out and bought a dress for her. Why would God care what I wore to church? She said. She did not go back. She said it was an ugly dress, too. The Mormons would say she was offended. Actually, she was seeing the absurdity of the Mormon view of what is really important in life. You know? And you can't help but think of the scripture about whited sepulchres. One devout Mormon insisted that he knew a lot of people who had left the church, and his opinion was that whatever reason they might give, the real reason was simply emotional. I think he has it backwards. It's usually some emotional vulnerability that makes people susceptible to the pretty picture painted by the missionaries. Converts are frequently people who are going through a difficult time in life, young people out on their own with no friends, families who have just lost a loved one in death, people trying to deal with depression, people with no support network. So people join the church when emotionally vulnerable. They leave the church when they realize that it's a sham and when they've seen how it really works. In other words, people join the church because of their emotional state, their inexperience, their lack of information. They leave when they've acquired some experience and some knowledge. To paraphrase Mark Twain, they join the church because of what they feel. They leave the church because of what they know. One big difference between the church and this ex-Mormon recovery movement is that we don't mind when people leave us. In fact, that's the whole purpose. When I think back over the 8 years or so that I've been involved, I can think of so many people who were very active and very much involved here then. Only a very few are still actively involved. Most have recovered and moved on, and that's the way it should be. I have seen ex-Mormons show up here among us full of anger and bitterness, which is quite understandable. And in a few years, they've come to terms with their Mormon past. They're ready to leave it behind. And they silently graduate into normal life. And I am so glad. Because we have been able to help hundreds and hundreds of people through that difficult time in their lives. Mormons often comment derisively that people can leave the church, but they can't seem to leave it alone. Well, I think that we help people to learn to leave it alone. I've received literally hundreds of emails thanking me and the others involved here for helping them out. I'll read you just one typical one from a fresh young apostate just back from his mission. I just wanted to thank you again for being such an incredible help. I honestly can't thank you enough for giving me someone to talk to or write to when I need it at most. I feel at peace like never before. And of course, there are some of us who maintain websites and write books and organize conferences who can't leave it alone. And that is because somebody has to call the church to account. Somebody has to put their feet to the fire. Somebody has to reach out a helping hand to the ones who've had to abandon this sinking, stinking ship, which they fear is taking them nowhere. And somebody needs to expose the lies that permeate the operation of this organization. It was the discovery of a lie by a prominent church leader that propelled me out. And as I studied more, I discovered, as we all do, more and more lies while paying lip service to the truth. You know, oh, say what is truth? This is the fairest gem, right? The church and its leaders continued to lie on a major scale, both to the members and to the public at large. And I'm not just referring to what I call the founding lie, namely that the father and son appeared to young Joe in 1820. That was just the beginning of a continuing stream of lies. Apostle John Taylor, on a mission in France in 1850, indignantly denying in a debate that the church was practicing polygamy, a despicable practice, when he had an entire harem of wives waiting at home for him in Utah. Brigham Young announcing to the world that the massacre at Mountain Meadows did not involve any Mormons. Or Gordon Hinckley denying that the church teaches that God was once a man, or saying that polygamy is not doctrinal. Lying seems to be part and parcel of the modus operandi of this church. The church seems to subscribe to the principle of Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels, who was quoted here today. I've got the entire quote. Goebbels said, "If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it. The lie can be maintained only for such time as the state can shield people from the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus, by extension, the truth is the greatest enemy of the state." Now, if you go back and you substitute the word church for state, you almost have a quote from Boyd K. Packer. In fact, if you were to sum up in one word what is fundamentally wrong about the Mormon church, that word, I suggest, would be lie. What is there about Mormonism that is not a lie? Families are forever. The church is not racist. Living the gospel will bring you happiness. Paying your tithing will bring you abundant material blessings. If you have enough faith, God will witness to you that the Book of Mormon is true. The Mormon church is the fastest growing faith in the world. And of course, Dwayne Minson took care of that, so I can skip ahead about 10 minutes here. In the past 10 years, we've seen a revolution in the technology of communication. Another sign, by the way, that to me that I am really getting old, you notice I don't have a PowerPoint presentation. In just the last 15 years, I can't keep up with the technology. You know, DVDs and cell phones and CD, music on CDs, those are all things that, cell phones that take pictures. The world is leaving me behind. Anyway, this revolution in technology, the internet, is comparable, many say, with the revolution 500 years ago, triggered by the invention of the printing press, making knowledge widely available to all. That revolution of the printing press invention was a primary factor in the Protestant Reformation, challenging the power of the Catholic Church. Our present revolution is having a similar impact, I think, on the Mormon Church, and we see it in the rapidly increasing number of Mormons leaving the church because of the information that they have found on the internet. I think we'll soon see major changes in the church as it shrinks and sees itself more frustrated in its missionary program. But the Mormon church is not going to disappear. The Catholic Church survived the Reformation, and 5 centuries later is still going strong. It seems to be surviving the scandal over the sexual abuse by priests. And the Mormon Church will also survive similar exposures and scandals. It lost a lot of members over the Book of Abraham, over the Hoffman forgeries, the public admission by Gordon Hinckley that he doesn't know much about some fundamental Mormon doctrines. But the church is not going to collapse. It will continue to make some converts, and it will keep many of its more docile and fearful members. As P.T. Barnum said, there's a sucker born every minute. And as long as it continues to exist, it will continue to destroy lives. I'm going to read you the last part of a story that was posted recently on the ex-Mormon bulletin board by an anonymous Mormon who began to realize the church was a cult when he got his endowment and was required to take so many strange oaths, to bow his head and say yes. But he silenced his inner questions, went on to marry a Mormon girl, and start a family. When he fully realized the enormity of the church lies and shared this feeling with his wife, she gave him the ultimatum. She would not remain married to a man who was not a good Mormon. This, by the way, was exactly the same ultimatum I got 45 years ago. To preserve his marriage and family, he gave in. And this is his message and plea to us, to those of you on the outside. I beg you, please do not forget us. Please remember the hundreds of thousands of unique, special, beautiful individuals that are currently serving life sentences in the prison of Mormonism. Please do not cease to pray to whatever God you serve for our deliverance. Some of us have no hope for redemption or liberation. For the greater good, we willingly sacrifice our souls upon the altar of conformity and orthodoxy. Our pain is real. Our sentence is absolute. To those of you on the outside, I thank you for your wisdom and your insight. I thank you for your compassion and understanding. I thank you for your stories. I thank you for showing me the truth and allowing me to bask in its warmth, even if for a small moment. I hope that truth will ultimately prevail. I hope that you and I will live to see it. Until that time, I go quietly, shackled and blinded once more into the prison that awaits me. Remember me. Remember us. I bid you all farewell. I bid farewell to progress. I bid farewell to truth. I bid farewell to reason. I bid farewell to freedom. I bow my head and say yes. Now, I will not presume to judge the courage of someone who leaves the church or the courage of someone like this man who stays in the church. I wouldn't presume to judge. We here are the fortunate ones. May we never again have to bow the head and say yes. Let us go then gratefully, with heads unbowed, with joyous hearts, free minds, into the brilliant, warm sunlight of that brave world beyond Mormonism.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.